So today we're going to be hearing from Vashti. She's one of the organisers of the conference, and very proud to say she's now a member of the Perth branch of Socialist Alternative. Yeah, pretty excited for us. So as per usual, we'll be leaving the discussion until the end after the talk, so definitely have a think about points you might want to raise in the discussion. Definitely welcome questions and disagreements and that sort of thing. But yeah, I'll pass it over to Vashti.
Cool. All right. So on the 9th of November in 1989, so 30 years ago this year, the Berlin Wall was torn down. And over the course of the next year or so, Stalinist regime after Stalinist regime across the Eastern Bloc fell. And for our conference, I think this is a particularly exciting anniversary to celebrate. One of our themes for this whole conference is tearing down the walls of oppression, the walls of division, the capitalist walls. And so for us, this kind of image that we see behind us is a wonderful, emblematic moment. And I thought we could kind of start off today with just some footage, if we can manage it. Maybe we cannot. Yeah, we can. Yep. So you kind of get a sense from that footage of the kind of absolute release of decades upon decades of pent-up anger, frustration, and, you know, joy from kind of both sides of the wall at the possibilities for something new to emerge out of something that had been so divisive and so horrible. And so I suppose today actually kind of give some sense of the kind of joys of the time, but also to try and go through some explanation as to why this wasn't just greeted universally with the same sort of welling up of kind of pride and happiness, you know, that I'm sure many of us kind of feel when we see that sort of footage there, because many of the kind of mythologies on both the left and the right about this event really need to be combated. So as many people would know, the neoliberal right wildly celebrated the demise of the Eastern Bloc. Actually, if you see kind of footage, I didn't get to include a whole bunch of the kind of photos across the course of a whole bunch of the different Eastern European revolutions, but there are just image after image of very prominent both neoliberal politicians, you know, like I think Princess Diana kind of visited, you know, a whole bunch of places. You know, Margaret Thatcher went and kind of celebrated. There's, you know, obviously David Hasselhoff, kind of you know, dodgy reputation, turned up to sing, weirdly, kind of at the falling of the Berlin Wall. So, you know, awful figure after awful figure from kind of history culminating in David Hasselhoff kind of, you know, turned up to kind of celebrate it. And the narrative that they were trying to present out of this whole situation was that this, you know, the end of the Eastern Bloc, the fall of the Berlin Wall, revealed the paucity of communism and the end of history as we know it, the kind of final victory of neoliberal capitalism, that now no alternative was possible or could even be envisaged. Well, on the traditional or the Stalinist left, many saw the revolutions as being a rejection of communism. And they were left writhing in a real sea of confusion and demoralisation over the failure of, according to them, really existing workers' states. Many were then led to reject Marxism altogether and embrace some form of market capitalism and social democracy as the only viable options left on the table. But I want to argue today that the uprisings across the region were a complete validation of Marxist politics. They were an inspiring indication of the capacity of ordinary people to take a stand against some of the most repressive, barbarous regimes in history. regimes that bastardised the words and language of communism in the name of dictatorship. And they were an indication of the real creativity and determination of workers, students and the oppressed to rip apart regimes that thwarted their potentials and their lives. So the uprisings were undeniably inspiring, but they were not the only factors that contributed to the collapse of the Iron Curtain. And I want to today talk a little bit about the internal and political dynamics of the Eastern Bloc, that kind of enabled this kind of general context that saw both the uprisings occur and then many of these kind of states be forced into a situation where they were forced to have a political transformation. And today I want to discuss the dynamic between these factors, the economic and political dimensions of the Stalinist regimes and the uprisings themselves. And finally, I want to make an argument as to what the collapse of the Bloc represented, that far from heralding the transformations of these societies from one social system to another, there was actually more continuity than change in terms of the underlying economic and social system. So I kind of want to start with... How do I move slides? There we go. Oh, okay. So I actually want to start with the USSR itself and talk briefly about glasnost and perestroika. So there was basically an underlying economic crisis that gripped the USSR and the Eastern Bloc in the 1980s. Understanding the nature of this crisis and its political consequences, I think, is really vital if we want to comprehend both the nature of the regimes themselves and then their demise. Since Stalin's counter-revolutionary consolidation in the decades after the Russian Revolution, the USSR's economy expanded massively and became a global powerhouse. This explanation was based on the super-exploitation of the working class and almost unprecedented levels of state control over investment. The driving dynamic of the USSR's economy was, however, military competition with the West, and for a period that could drive significant economic growth. But over time, it led to the prioritisation of investment in heavy industry and heavy industrial production over and above the reproduction of the means of production in other sectors. So by the 1960s, the USSR's economy began to stagnate. Simultaneously, the trend towards globalisation in the West allowed the US to find new markets internationally. And this was the other kind of crucial factor in the collapse of the Soviet Empire. The forms of organisation which had transformed the Soviet Union into a superpower and industrialised Eastern Europe no longer corresponded to worldwide patterns of development. So the heavy state intervention into the economy and the kind of autarkic or self-controlled nature of trade and production meant that the Eastern Bloc was left behind during those sorts of changes. So there was a period of unprecedented stagnation and crisis which occurred during the period of 1970 to 1982, when production of 40% of all industrial goods actually fell. So between 1981 and 1985, there was practically no economic growth at all in Soviet Russia, and a similar dynamic occurred across the rest of the bloc. And so you can see, you know, there's a few kind of images from the period here of completely empty shops. And there was another trend whereby, because of the kind of levels, there wasn't enough industry to kind of warrant the high levels of employment that had existed previously, to which people were kind of accustomed, the state began kind of programs of just getting people to do kind of menial, kind of almost meaningless sort of jobs. So, I mean, it's not meaningless to kind of sweep streets, but, you know, just kind of employed lots of people in this sort of labour. So powerful economic forces threatened the USSR and the rest of the Eastern Bloc with collapse until its own closed economy was somehow broken open. So there was kind of this economic impetus for the rulers of the USSR to look to try and find ways of actually breaking open the economy, to open it up more to other parts of the world economy so as to kind of allow more investment kind of internationally. Because the Russian economy was capitalist, it was subject to many of the same pressures as other capitalist economies, but pressures that were given a particular spin by the state capitalist dimensions of their societies. What's more, unless the Russian economy was seen in the context of its global interactions, it was impossible to kind of comprehend the dynamics at all. So what were the kind of implications of this expansion? So from the 1960s onwards, Russia saw a massive urbanisation of the population. In 1960, the urban population was 49%, and in 1985, it was 70%. So it's kind of starting off from a very kind of low base. But that urbanisation was accompanied by a rise in the education of the workforce, increasing social encounters with societies beyond the peasant village, and there was a widening of horizons. Lots of expectations in this period had been raised by these kind of economic and social processes which were going on. So there was the development of an urbanised layer, a managerial, professional and intellectual class began to grow. And they increasingly objected to the realities of Soviet political life and began to cohere behind new and different oppositional forms, some explicitly political, some proto-political. So there was kind of a fairly famous sort of punk, you know, USSR sort of rock punk scene that developed. And the similar sorts of developments occurred within the working class. So independent trade unions began to spring up. There began to be kind of increases in low-level agitation in many workplaces across the USSR itself. And at the same time, the kind of economic slowdown that we see meant that the raised expectations of the population began to be thwarted and to kind of butt up against the realities of the system. So these economic and social pressures mounted on the Soviet ruling classes, and conflicts developed in the bureaucracy itself. So the ruling bureaucracy of the USSR began to kind of be divided increasingly into different camps between reformers who wanted to modernise this kind of flagging state capitalist economy and the conservatives who felt that it had served them very well up until now and why not continue on in the manner that they had been organising for so long. So they wanted to continue the status quo. And those tensions were played out most clearly in the election of Mikhail Gorbachev to general secretaryship of the Russian party. And Gorbachev began to introduce or floated the introduction of something he called glasnost and perestroika. Glasnost meaning openness and perestroika meaning reform. So I want to spend a little bit of time talking about what was actually going on in Russia, from both above and below, because there was clearly this kind of interaction and relationship between what was happening in the splits in the bureaucracy, what was happening on the ground in workplaces and amongst these kind of newly urbanised layers of the society. So glasnost and perestroika was essentially an attempt to reform the USSR by opening it up to the West economically and by downgrading inter-imperial competition, which would then lead to the possibility of more investment in other markets and fields, hence the rapprochement between Gorbachev and the West. It also meant shaking up sections of the bureaucracy which had grown fat and dishonest and stagnant in their positions of power. And laziness and dishonesty sort of became kind of structural in this period. So, you know, any attempts to look at the kind of actual realities of the economic situation in the USSR were consistently stymied by inflated figures, lies, and it was just, you know, the whole setup was very difficult to kind of cut through. But it should be said that none of these reforms were motivated by a kind of genuine reforming zeal, a desire for genuine peace between the peoples of the world, which is how lots of these kind of meetings were framed, or hostility to kind of bureaucracy per se. The changes were part of a project of developing Russian capitalism to meet the needs of late 20th century global capitalism. Nevertheless, any discussion about a kind of splits that were occurring within the bureaucracy or an opening up of the Russian economy on any and of Russian society, of Soviet society, in kind of any way, shape or form, allowed the space for there to be the development of on-the-ground kind of mobilisations. And glasnost and perestroika raised the population's hopes and encouraged thoughts of freedom. So despite Gorby's best intentions, glasnost and perestroika unleashed a force that the regime could not control. And Alex Kalinikos, who is a British Marxist, put it very well when he said, "They opened Pandora's box, freeing an effervescent throng of political forces that threatened the very existence of the Stalinist state itself. So there were there began to be unsanctioned demonstrations that chanted Gorby's name. Oppositional groups were beginning to form using the excuse of glasnost. And so Gorby kind of played this double-edged game. He wanted to both encourage some reform, some loosening up of the system, while simultaneously discouraging much more initiative and glasnost, obviously. Kind of the idea of kind of openness could only ever go so far, you know, for this appalling apparatchik. Nevertheless, by 1989, a general sense of malaise had swept the whole country. The reform economist deputy minister, Abalkin, complained. A wave of strikes has engulfed the economy. There is a continual whipping up of tension, a continual sort of blackmail along the lines of, if you don't solve these issues, then we shall go on strike. That kind of blackmail, you know. And on top of these kind of economic struggles, national minorities were expressing their grievances from one end of the USSR to another. So there were strikes in Latvia, Estonia, Moldavia, and Georgia. Lithuania was demanding independence. And Pravda, the kind of main newspaper of the Soviet USSR, reported that for several months the peoples of Tashkent and several other towns in Uzbekistan have known no peace. Unsanctioned rallies are constantly being held in the streets. And in Armenia and Azerbaijan, there was basically a civil war after the central Russian state sent troops in to quell the opposition movements. Now, not all of the hostility was directed against the state. There was very nasty pogroms between different ethnic groups, and some of these were encouraged by different sections of the old regime. And, you know, not all of these kind of mobilizations were particularly leftist, kind of in content or progressive. You know, some of them were kind of downright, you know, objectionable in lots of ways. But nonetheless, the kind of levels of ferment that was occurring right across the very vast swathes of the USSR really kind of gives a sense of like the level of you know, the kind of cauldron-like nature of what was going on. So all of those, so everywhere there was growing discontent, and whole sections of the bureaucracy began to turn against each other. In the Ukraine, the party split from the centralized Russian party, and in that turmoil, it all kind of strengthened the hand and gave confidence to workers, many of whom flocked to join independent unions, and a major strike wave swept the mines. So all of those factors came together to seriously undermine the strength of the Russian state. They felt underconfident at this point to intervene militarily at so many places, at so many points of time, to crush all of the uprisings of the national minorities. And they were, you know, facing kind of fires right across the whole of the Eastern Bloc, and they, you know, didn't have either the kind of manpower without a huge kind of mobilization of the whole of the Russian military to kind of intervene in all of these places all at once. And so were really struck dumb to some degree in terms of what they were going to do. But much of the turmoil that was occurring, you know, from the kind of 1987 onwards across the USSR led to a sense of kind of increased confidence to rebel across the rest of the Eastern Bloc. One of the key links in the chain of events that occurred in 1989 was in Poland. And as people might know, there had been an amazing, wonderful struggle of near-revolutionary proportions in Poland in 1979 and 1980. Workers had virtually taken over production in various towns and cities across the country. And out of that huge struggle in 1980, a major trade union federation, Solidarność, or Solidarity, had emerged as the key political player. The Polish state had managed to crush that kind of magnificent movement in 1980 through brutal force, but the reverberations of the Solidarity uprisings were to be felt 9 years later, and many of the kind of organising structures that had begun in 1980 still had left some roots, some kind of underground legacy for people to bring back up to the surface when the opening was there. But the economic difficulties of the bloc, combined with a major strike wave across Poland in 1988, led the old regime to want to eventually negotiate with some elements of Solidarność, and a transitional government was formed. Many of the ex-strike leaders who had credibility amongst the movement became part of this new government, and they felt that compromise with the existing regime and a transition to liberal democracy was really the only solution. And unfortunately, coming at, in kind of 1988 and the start of 1989 as it did, the Poland solution became a trendsetter for the kind of rest of the dynamics which would occur from on there. So it seemed to offer a road forward for those reformers in the bureaucracy who saw an opportunity to ease into a new economic and political scenario without their power being usurped. It also offered a gilded path forward for those liberal reformers who wanted mere political transformations without the possibilities of increased workers' power or of any significant transformation to the economic base of society. So to turn to East Germany, at the same time as the events in Poland were kind of unfolding, the situation was heating up in East Germany as well. And I understand Klaus gave a wonderful talk yesterday kind of detailing much more of the kind of the tearing down of the wall and the movement around it. But I think it's just worth reiterating a little bit here. Because people often think of the kind of tearing down of the Berlin Wall just with the images that I kind of started with tonight, as though that was kind of the sum total of the kind of whole movement. You know, people just turn up to the wall, magically pickaxes appear, you know, from either side, you know, and then all of a sudden the wall comes down and everyone's kind of happy, bar the David Hasselhoff scene. But there was much, much more going on than that. Between 1989 in August and April in 1990, 2,600 public demonstrations and over 300 rallies took place, as well as over 200 strikes and a dozen factory occupations. And the largest of three of the 2,600 demonstrations attracted well over 1 million people. No accurate figures exist for the total number of participants in demonstrations and public protests, but that it was millions and, you know, over a million at least is indisputable. And one researcher actually estimates the figure as something closer to around 5 million. So organising had been going on underground for quite a while in East Germany. In mid-January in 1989, activists in Leipzig secretly delivered thousands of leaflets into mailboxes. They announced a public demonstration for civil liberties and democratic renewal. Undeterred by a massive show of force by police and the Stasi, some 500 to 800 gathered, the bulk of whom attempted to march to the nearby Liebknecht Monument. Although police prevented the march from reaching its destination and made scores of arrests, the protesters had shown that public demonstrations could be organised in the teeth of repression. And it was a success that resonated across the country. And so prayer and information meetings drew crowds to churches all over East Germany to show support for the Leipzig detainees. And the churches became places of organising as one of the kind of sanctuary areas where people could organise, much like in Poland in 1980. A further flashpoint occurred in early June, and this is a really interesting kind of connection, because not only was there the kind of turmoil which was occurring across the USSR, in 1989, obviously there was the uprisings in China, the students in Tiananmen Square, and there was demonstrations in East Germany that actually, mobilised publicly and called for, more for support to be given to the students and workers who were demonstrating in Tiananmen Square. There were also reported cases of workers writing collective protest letters to the Chinese ambassador. And although the majority of protests actually remained within the churches, dozens of small public events occurred too. So, for instance, one in Dresden involved drumming in solidarity with Tiananmen victims. You know, in Australia, when people bring out the drums at demonstrations, it's usually a bad sign. But in this instance, I think, you know, it really was a kind of a wonderful display of solidarity. And 40 drummers were arrested. Another more typical protest was staged by students who hung a large banner over a fence with the words, "We're mourning for the deaths in China." So kind of connections were being made, not just across the Eastern Bloc, but across the whole of the Stalinist regime. On the 6th of October in 1989, the DDR marked its 40th anniversary, and Gorbachev actually arrived to attend the celebrations. one of the leading organisations of resistance, and maybe in the discussion we can talk a little bit more about some of the politics of the resistance organisations and classes here, so maybe he can tell us a little bit more. But one of the key ones was this thing called Neues Forum, which was a dissident kind of civil rights organisation, and they'd been banned after their formation in the previous month. But nonetheless, some 1,000 people were arrested the day that Gorbachev arrived, and another 3,456 during the rest of his visit. So to mark the anniversary, the state held a torchlight procession through the streets of Berlin. But as they marched to order, the crowds that had initially been mobilised to celebrate kind of the fall of the formation of the DDR began to chant Gorby, Gorby, which kind of, you know, gives you a sense of the kind of complete contradiction of the situation, but also that this was an expression of kind of rebellion in the context, where any little chinks and openings were seen to be, kind of a radical challenge to the status quo. Increasingly, disaffection occurred in the workplace. So, for instance, one manual worker reported to a researcher that in early and mid-October in his workplace, there was an incredible and rapid politicisation, that a really astonishing ferment of politics and discussion and debate that had all been previously shut down because of the concerns about the security state. The Stasi, which was the secret police in the DDR, had more spies in more homes and more workplaces than anywhere else across the whole of the Eastern Bloc. It was one of the most tightly surveilled societies probably that has ever existed. So that had obviously put a limit on the capacities of people to, or the confidence of people to kind of talk often and freely. But nonetheless, discussions began to be taking place everywhere. So on the shop floor, over lunch, in the toilets, anywhere, basically, at workplaces where people could kind of start to discuss how things could change. And this worker said that at first you'd find one or two others who you wanted to talk to, and then gradually there was more and more. And workers were becoming more confident. So, for instance, at the Karl Marx Stadtfactory, which is a hilarious kind of irony in that title, workers resolved to eject the SED functionaries from their positions. And one of those present recounts the story. The apparatchik would just sit in his office, hiding behind Neues Deutschland. So we said, by the 9th of the month, he must be gone. And when that day arrived, colleagues pulled the lever, switching off the current. All the machines were now silent, and we, the Enterprise Council, together with the rest of the workforce, walked 3 laps of the main hall until we could see that he had packed his case and left the factory grounds. So the mere kind of marching in silence, and kind of menacing silence at that, you can kind of imagine it, around this kind of, huge factory, just waiting and watching the head kind of apparatchik kind of pack up his bags and kind of quickly leave. That's the sort of thing that was happening more and more across the area. And then on the 7th of October, violent arrests accompanied a 6,000-strong march in East Berlin. The next day, 30,000 marched in Dresden, and on the same day of the 8th of October, special security forces were put on alert. For the following day's demonstration in Leipzig, huge numbers of police plus ambulances and hospital services were mobilised. And the next day, 50,000 people marched in Leipzig. District party bosses refused to authorise the use of live ammunition. And all of this kind of led up to the situation where on the 4th of November, 500,000 attended a rally in East Berlin as tens of thousands left the country through a new open border. And in an attempt to stem the tide, the regime announced that the border crossings to West Germany were open and there was just a flood of people out. The unexpected consequences was that crowds gathered on both sides of the Berlin Wall and began to dismantle it, as we saw at the start, with picks and hammers. And these were very magnificent scenes. But unfortunately, no independent left was built, and the result was very similar to Poland. Indeed, one diplomat said, "The agreement left little room for citizen input. It was the hour of the policymaker and the bureaucrat. It relegated people to being subjects rather than agents of change." But, so while there was so much kind of hanging in the balance, not much substantial had changed. So the promises of fundamental transformation of society were there, the promise was there, but those promises were not realised. And almost nowhere was this clearer than in Hungary. So the events in Hungary offered a perfect example of the way that the ruling class actually reconstituted itself from a state capitalist ruling class to one that was on top of a mixed market and state-run capitalist economy. The Hungarian ruling class, prompted by the onset of economic stagnation, had opened up to the West from around the 1970s onwards. And over a few decades, the leading figures in the bureaucracy had begun bending this expansion more and more towards their own gain. So one economist noted, since the writing appeared on the wall in 1987, the party and state bureaucracy has been trying to convert their bureaucratic power into a new type of power, which will be an asset that can be preserved within a new system, namely in a market economy or even in a democracy. And that result may be called what the British Marxist Chris Harman called the rise of a kind of 19th century grand bourgeoisie, an amalgam of different elements of the old ruling class. And another commentator described it like this. He said, the characteristic oligarchic family in the mid-1980s was the father or grandfather, a party apparatchik, a high-level party or state official, his son, a manager of a British-Hungarian joint venture, his son-in-law with a boutique, a daughter, an editor for Hungarian television, his nephew studying at Cambridge or Oxford, his mother-in-law having a small hotel or boarding house on Lake Balaton. The family businesses are top secret. So they also began to sell off party buildings, training centres and holiday complexes into semi-private or joint stock companies. And so all of this began to kind of lay the basis for quite a smooth transition from, you know, one kind of, you know, form of capitalism to another, you know, and with a relatively kind of stable transmission from the old kind of bureaucratic ruling class into a new sort of half-bureaucratic ruling class into kind of free market capitalism. But the one major exception to this general pattern, and the last one I'll talk about today, was in Romania. Whereas many of the other Eastern European regimes had adjusted quite slowly to the capitalism of the 1970s, Romania remained unreconstructed and unreformed. The bureaucracy was held together by the collective terror at the powerful and brutal and tightly knit Ceausescu family. When faced with opposition, the Ceausescus were far more likely to respond with the traditional responses of Eastern European rulers, which was repression. And the revolt in Romania came in mid-December in 1989, when a pastor in the town of Timișoara was served with a deportation order. In response to this injustice, the pastor was actually ethnically Hungarian, and there was a huge level of kind of oppression of ethnically Hungarian speakers. You know, there, several hundred townspeople blockaded his house to stop his deportation from being enforced. And the next day, Ceausescu ordered the military to fire, and they did, and they killed 71 people. And in the following days, the protests grew, both in Timișoara and around the country. Troops withdrew from Timișoara when workers threatened to blow up the petrochemical plant that they worked at, and 50,000 people marched on the Communist Party headquarters and absolutely ransacked it from top to bottom. And from here, things spiraled up quickly from our perspective, spiraled down quickly from the Ceausescu's perspective. And the next day, their power collapsed. Fighting spread, and over the course of the revolution, over 700 people died. Ceausescu tried on the 22nd of December to address a crowd outside of the Communist Party Central Committee building, but the crowd again broke into this building, and Ceausescu had to flee by helicopter from the roof. The army joined the battle against the secret police as crowds captured the TV and radio stations, and Ceausescu and his wife were captured and shot 3 days later on Christmas Day in 1989. Now, unfortunately, Ceausescu's regime had been so repressive that the workers' opposition groups were malnourished and weak, and the forces which came to the fore of the revolution were unfortunately just another section of the old regime, but, you know, this, you know, supported and backed by this wonderful kind of mass movement. But I think this point cuts to the heart of much of the political reality of the events of 1989, and it raises the question as to the exact nature of the revolutions of the period and the extent to which we can even call them revolutions. The British social theorist Perry Anderson calls revolution an episode of convulsive political transformation, compressed in time and concentrated in target, that has a determinate beginning with the old state apparatus intact and a finite end when that apparatus is decisively ended and a new one is erected in its stead. And I think that's a reasonable kind of pithy summary of the idea of what, how you might define a revolution. And I think to the extent that we accept that kind of brief definition, we can say that there was a kind of revolution in Eastern Europe, but it was a limited revolution, a political rather than a social revolution. So while there was a political transformation, a transformation in the exact nature and way that capitalism operated in these countries, the fundamental mode of exploitation was not transformed. So many of the transformations in the state structure of the Eastern Bloc regimes occurred without any massive level of conflict, violence, or even mass mobilisation. So I've kind of talked about the high points here, but, regime after regime, the transformation kind of occurred with relative stability. What's more, in many instances, large elements of the structures of the state were largely left unchanged. The military, the media, the legal systems were often peopled with the same individuals who were powerful under the previous regimes. And what's more, the heads of the enterprises, the old state-run enterprises, often became bosses in the free market. And the ease of that transition is a clear demonstration of the non-socialist nature of these regimes. After all, if they were genuinely communist countries, surely the counter-revolution would have involved a much more serious upheaval shaking out of what the state structures actually were. Nevertheless, for the many thousands who did participate in mobilisations against the Stalinist regimes, the reality of 21st century market capitalism has been just as disastrous. There is endemic unemployment across Eastern Europe, and the populations of these countries have been one of the biggest refugee populations in the world. The collapse of the Soviet Empire, rather than proving the end of history, has rather allowed us to point out the necessity of ongoing, thoroughgoing, and genuine revolutionary transformations of capitalism. And I just wanted to conclude with a quote from the British Marxist and comedian Mark Steele, who talked about watching the overthrow of the Ceausescus and their killing, their murder. what's a better word for it? I don't know. On Christmas Eve in the year they were killed. And he said, "The world has seen and studied these events, and in the autumn of 1989, following mass demonstrations in Hungary and East Germany, the borders to the west were relaxed, and then the Berlin Wall was knocked down." The Berlin Wall. It was like hearing that someone had dismantled Mount Everest or filled in the Pacific Ocean. Revolution had swept through the region until a huge crowd assembled in Bucharest, where they'd been ordered to cheer the Romanian leader, Nicolae Ceausescu. As he waved to the crowd, a section booed. On the television, you could see Ceausescu's shocked face. Within seconds, the whole crowd was booing and the revolution was underway. The unanswerable question is, who started the booing? Someone must have been whispering to a friend, "I'm thinking of booing. If I start, will you join in?" Maybe the whole crowd was alive with mutterings of "you." But the underlying animosity towards the dictators, combined with the sense that as governments fell around them, anything was possible, meant that one boo was enough to spark a revolution. But if no one had been the one to start, they might have cheered and wandered home with their normal resentment. And I think if there's a kind of metaphorical lesson for us out of all of that, then it needs to be that we all need to be the socialists who start the booing against capitalism from Melbourne to Moscow.